I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This time, it's with the very model of the modern documentary filmmaker, the Oscar-winning Errol Morris. He won the Oscar for The Fog of War, about Robert McNamara and the war in Vietnam. But now he's in the thick of our cultural politics again with SOP, which means Standard Operating Procedure. It's a film about the Iraqi prison that became an American torture chamber at Abu Ghraib. Again, Errol Morris, we're proud and privileged to admire you as a friend and to have you take this new film apart with us in James Dedarian's class here at Brown on global media. Errol, tell us what the project was and what is this film that you produced?
The simplest way to describe this whole enterprise, it's an attempt to contextualize a set of photographs that everybody knows about. The problem is that photographs don't show you all those things that were not photographed. It may seem the perfect statement of the obvious, but it's not so obvious that it isn't endlessly overlooked by people. You see, I have confined myself to an examination of a very, very, very small piece of this war, actually a very small piece of Abu Ghraib itself, privates, specialists, sergeants. What could I possibly hope to learn by doing something like that? And the answer is, I hope to learn a lot to get a picture of this war that perhaps no one else has really been interested in getting or sought to get, but that tells us a lot about the nature of the war and a lot about ourselves. I might add, regrettably. I am endlessly fascinated by error. Error is my stock in trade. How people make mistakes about how they see the world, how people think that they are in possession of certain truth and, in fact, far from it. They have little or no idea of what actually is happening around them.
You say this movie tells us a lot about ourselves, but the question is what and who? And maybe to go right to the question that has haunted me for 2 days since I saw this movie, the question is this or isn't it a blood sample of the whole war and the whole society? I suspect it is. That is, that the project of the war was condensed in this prison. And the project of the war was all about humiliation and domination, a kind of fierce contempt for Arabs and Muslims, a determination to bring down people they had no way of communicating with. They had no evidence of what they'd done, with every imaginable sexual and personal human degradation. And it does tell us a lot about ourselves. It tells us a story of ignorance at war, an incredible imbalance of power, cruelty unleashed, fortified by government and all sorts of meaningless slogans about warfare and what they did to us. It will stand, I'm afraid, as a horrendous indictment of this country that we love so much. Let's get to it.
One of the most infamous photographs from Abu Ghraib is a photograph of Lindy England, 20 years old at the time, 5 feet tall, I believe, under 100 pounds, holding what in effect is a tie-down strap. A prisoner named Gus, who is naked on the ground, And the photograph is taken by Lindy England's then boyfriend, Chuck Grainer. Well, the photograph, of course, has fascinated me for many, many, many reasons. And here would be the central reason. And I think this will make you happy. I believe it's a picture of graphic representation of American foreign policy. Mm. Pure and simple. Photographs become iconic for some reason. They answer to certain ideas or beliefs that we have. It's not just simply by happenstance. Oddly enough, I know that that method of removing Gus from his cell had been approved by the medical authorities at Abu Ghraib. There was nothing, quote unquote, illegal about what was happening. But in fact, the photograph, notwithstanding, is absolutely appalling. Because part of our foreign policy, and make no mistake about this, was this idea that American women should be used to humiliate Iraqi men. Without the thought, of course, that this might be degrading to the American women as well. It's not something that was devised by a handful of MPs on one tier at Abu Ghraib. Mm. It was part of our foreign policy. And one of the things that I find most appalling is that the photographs were used to blame a handful of MPs, really letting everybody else off the hook, as if somehow no one else was involved in this. It was just these guys, one tier. By the way, Abu Ghraib was not one tier or two tiers. It was a city. There were close to 10,000 prisoners at the end of 2003. We're talking about a vast concentration camp, in essence, in the middle of the Sunni Triangle. The pictures are misleading in that respect as well. They make you think that you're dealing with something much, 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 much smaller, much more confined than the reality of what was there.
There are obviously aesthetic and philosophical and media issues and levels of meaning in this project, and you've just summarized them for me. But most people are going to see this as a portrait of Americans at war. Male, female, guilty, innocent, officers, enlisted. That's how I saw it, and I think that's how the Martian would see it, or Africans, or Europeans, or Chinese. What do you take that statement to be? What were you driving at? What do you think you got?
I'll give you an example. I have a piece that is going up in the New York Times. The New York Times has been endlessly quibbling about this essay, and my hope is that it goes up intact within the next week or so. But I wrote an essay basically about one photograph, and that's the photograph of Sabrina Harmon smiling with her thumb up over the corpse of an Iraqi prisoner, Al Jamadi. There's an extraordinary piece written in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer that came out in 2005, in which she talks about the death of Al Jamadi and the question of why hasn't anyone ever been prosecuted for his death. I would go so far as to say, why has no one ever been prosecuted for his murder? But the story is actually even more twisted and perverse, which of course appeals to someone of my sensibilities. Not only was no one really punished for the murder of Al Jamadi, the wrong person was held indirectly accountable, and that was Sabrina Harmon. Very, very, very quickly, this is a man who was brought by the CIA and the Navy SEALs to Abu Ghraib. He was interrogated. He was killed, in all likelihood, by one CIA interrogator. We know his name. His name is Mark Swanner. Following his death, and this is certainly part of the movie that you just saw, MPs were called. It's not clear whether they knew he was dead or not. MPs were called to, quote unquote, tie him a little higher. You heard from Frost and from Diaz in the movie. They realize he is dead. Maybe the CIA officer realized that before. Maybe he didn't. Who in hell knows? And then there was what? There was a cover-up. They packed the body on ice while they were trying to figure out how to get rid of it. The guy in all the logs is referred to as Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's, the corpse that no one wants to deal with. They want to find a way to make it go away. The proverbial hot potato. No one wants to be left with the hot potato in hand. And so they contrive a way, and this involves the top brass of Abu Ghraib and involves the head of the prison, Colonel Thomas Pappas. It involves the head of the MPs, Jerry Philibaum, two captains, Captain Reese, Captain Brinson, decide that they will take him out of Abu Ghraib on a gurney with an IV in his arm. And the MP soldiers are told that this is a heart attack victim. This guy, unfortunately, had a sudden coronary infarct at Abu Ghraib, and now we are going to take him out of the prison. What does Sabrina Harmon do? Sabrina Harmon, from her supervisor, gets the key to the shower room on 1B, and she goes in. I know from my data on the photographs, I know second by second the order that these photographs were taken, when they were taken. The first photograph she takes is the photograph of the smile and the thumbs up. Grainer asks her to pose for a picture, and then he poses for a picture that she herself takes of him. The following over a dozen pictures are detailed pictures of Al Jamadi's corpse. She leaves, she comes back an hour and a half later, and she takes another 15 or so detailed pictures of Al Jamadi's corpse, culminating with the picture taken of the damage to his eye. She peels back a bandage that has been put on his eye to cover up what is underneath and takes a close-up photograph of that as well. You may know from reading the New Yorker article, I don't know who has read it, who hasn't read it, that Sabrina wanted to be a forensic photographer. She had joined the military because she wanted money to go to college. Her father is a cop. Her brother is a cop. She herself wanted to be a cop. Okay. I look at those photographs that she took as an act of civil disobedience. In her letter to her girlfriend, she is a lesbian, to her wife, as she describes Kelly, she says, I wanted to show that the military is nothing but lies. Now, here's something that I would love to talk about here, which I find endlessly interesting. People can't see this, and I use that C word, literally. People can't see this. But this is a story that goes well beyond a question of torture. This is a story of our collective need not to face reality and to scapegoat others. We are no different than the administration that we actually decry. I would show the movie to people, and they would get into arguments about it. Some people would come out of the movie and feel sympathy for these bad apples. Other people would feel really, really angry. I saw one couple, two august professors, in argument about this. The wife saying that they're people just like you and me. The husband saying it proves to me just how debased and how morally obtuse these people really, really were. I don't think people see anything, including my movie. Why should my movie be any different than anything else? People see nothing. That's just it. And it doesn't matter if Sabrina writes all these letters where she clearly shows an ethical dimension. Much, much more disturbing, by the way, is the thought that these people all have an ethical dimension and are actually thinking about ethical issues all through this. Much easier to ascribe this to some kind of sociological phenomena or some kind of simple algorithm like the banality of evil. Much simpler. And I love Hannah Arendt. It's just that I would it's people, they truck this phrase out as if they've said anything. They've said nothing. Nothing. They've looked at nothing, thought about nothing. Sorry.
I want to just volunteer the thought that you can't see the roots of this evil in this film, and it's the one long, without the higher-ups, without the real commanders and the political chieftains back in Washington. And one thing that's somewhat left out of the movie is the fact that Abu Ghraib was a byword for terrorism in Iraq under the Saddam Hussein regime. I mean, it was the quintessence of his ultimate sort of discipline on the society.
Yeah, okay. There are lots of ironies here.
Okay. But, I mean, among the ironies was that in a war of so-called liberation, one of the first tools that we adopted was his most notorious prison system. And one of your troops says, you know, we came in there and had to sweep all the shit and the urine and the stink out of the old prison and put the new prisoners in it. But the question of, you know, this whole story just slipped right by the presidential season of 2004.
Oh, it didn't slip by. It was very influential in that presidential season.
But it didn't turn the result.
It did, absolutely. In my view,
Abu Ghraib
ensured George Bush's reelection in 2004.
Well, this is what has to be dealt with at a political level.
Here's why. Errol's crackpot theory. And I apologize for yelling and carrying on. Here's Errol's crackpot theory on the 2004 election. The seven bad apples and the pictures did George W. Bush an incredible favor because they gave him and his administration someone to blame. If you have the following set of questions, why does the Arab world hate us? Look at those guys. Why is the war going south? Look at those guys. Why is the insurgency growing? Of course, the insurgency was growing well before the pictures were taken, but people don't have a memory for anything, so that's not a problem. Why is the insurgency growing? Look at these guys. It gives you a kind of simple algorithm. The stab in the back theory. We went into this war with the best of intentions. These rogue soldiers acting on their own initiative have severely compromised American foreign policy and our war effort. They effectively stabbed not just the administration, they stabbed America in the back. And often we talk about the photographs as the photographs that destroyed America's self-image, its picture of itself. Now, remember, I said it's Errol's crackpot theory. It could be Errol's crackpot wrong theory, but
as a cover story, Errol, I mean, it's a tale told by an idiot. I mean, the idea. the next question is, well, remind me, Mr. President, why did we move right into Saddam's most notorious prison and set up shop with our own thugs? You did that, Mr. President, or Mr. Secretary of Defense. Let's talk about it. That was not an accident, and that wasn't seven bad apples.
And also addressing the question of the essence of the foreign policy, I would say the essence of the foreign policy is something that we have embraced in all of this, and that's scapegoating, misdirection, scapegoating, and the avoidance of responsibility. Mm-hmm. To me, I have to confess, torture is a red herring, as strongly as I feel about torture. When I think of the foreign policy of this country over the last, whatever it is, 6, 7 years, the foreign policy is show people who's boss, beat the shit out of people who disagree with you, show who the tougher man, the bigger man is. I think for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, our entire foreign policy as a country, 300 million people, our entire foreign policy was kill Saddam.
Can I give you a word that sums it up pretty well? It's the one word, strangely enough, a very wonderful psychiatrist told me he's searched Freud upside and down and can't find this word. The word is humiliation, emasculation, degradation, and he's surprised not to find it in Freud simply because in all kinds of experience, in and out of American foreign policy, it is a formative thing to see one's... He was speaking about seeing his own Italian immigrant father sort of put down in, I think it was upstate New York, it doesn't matter, but because of his accent, because of his roots. God knows people of color experience it all the time, but the formative power of humiliation seems to me that's what we see at the very most local, retail, low level in your film. People train,
and at the highest
level. Well, of course, we know it's at the highest level.
I think it's so... And here's one of the great ironies, much greater than the fact that we just stupidly took the symbol of Saddam's, you know, torture autocracy and made it our own. That's pretty ironic and pretty incredibly stupid. But aside from that,
irony is saying one thing and meaning another. What if there was no irony at all here? What if they said it and meant it? We're in the Abu Ghraib business now. We just moved in.
Yeah.
The line forms over there.
Here's what strikes me about it. You have a president and his advisors who want to humiliate Saddam Hussein and show him who's boss. And what better way to do that than is to, you know, destroy his country and root him out of some spider hole, as it's described, and hang him. Oddly enough, in the process of humiliating Saddam, our foreign policy in its essence, a group of American soldiers carrying out on some micro level our policy of humiliation and scapegoating take pictures of it, some of them taking these pictures because they're nervous about what they're doing and want a record of it because they think they can protect themselves in part by taking pictures. Okay? The pictures get out. That's another complete misconception of how the pictures get out. Hmm. The pictures get out despite enormous efforts on the part of the military to prevent them from being leaked. The pictures are leaked because we live in a digital age and there's really no way to contain that kind of stuff anymore. The pictures get out, and guess what? They humiliate the administration and the American people and the military. And so what does the administration and the military do because they feel humiliated? Well, guess what? They try to humiliate the soldiers who humiliated them while they were in the process of humiliating Iraq. And so it goes. This is the world as we know it today. I was reading, and I am babbling, and I forget. I asked for your
forgiveness. You're babbling good, brother.
Well, here's a story for you. My distributor, Sony, sent me to the offices of the MPAA in Los Angeles to make a case for why the movie should receive an R rating. This is of great concern to distributors because the rating that you get an R as opposed to an NC-17 will affect its commercial distribution. I feel that its underlying subject matter was even more of a problem. But at the time, I'm making a case before this woman who runs the MPAA. And I said some variant of what I said here about humiliation. And she said, funny you should mention that. Horror movies, because she has to watch everything. Horror movies since the war began have changed. They're all about humiliating people. Of course, you kill them in the end. But first, you degrade them, you humiliate them, and then you kill them. And she said, all of these movies like Saw and like Hostel are based on a new idea. And she said she hadn't thought of it before, but it seemed to her that it was something that actually emerged out of the war. And I found that, and still find it, really, really, really interesting, that it is deeply part of the zeitgeist. I wonder what this administration teaches young people. The example that we have set for how you conduct yourself in the world. And I don't think it's a terribly good example. I think it's one of the things that I find truly frightful.
Let's leave it there and let's hear from students. Please give us your name and fire away.
I'm sorry.
My name is Michael and I'm a senior here at Brown. In my viewing of the movie, I saw two different understandings of standard operating procedure. There is the first instance in where there's the chain of command, who makes these rules, who determines what's standard. And in the other instance, there's the moment where, I forget the man's name, but he's stamping photographs, standard operating procedure.
Pack. Yes.
And I think that a lot of the criticism that's been associated with the movie has to do with that first instance in where you didn't go up the chain of command, didn't interview people above that level, but still have something to say about how the decision-making process occurs. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your decision not to interview people above a certain level of rank, because I think that the second instance in which you're questioning the truthfulness that we can get from photographs, that we can discern what is violent, what is not, what is torture, what is standard operating procedure. I think that's a real success for the movie, and I wonder if you have that same view that there are those two different things going on.
I do. It's hard for me not to be defensive because I'm defensive by nature. maybe it's an occupational hazard.
Did you ask Donald Rumsfeld?
Actually, I asked all these people. The people who really fascinated me were some of the upper-level chain of command that actually were in Iraq. Barbara Fast, who was the brigadier general and then the major general in charge of intelligence, Colonel Bolts, Major General Wojciechowski, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. We tried to get lots and lots of people. Captain Carolyn Wood. All of these people were of enormous interest, and they are discussed. Carolyn Wood is discussed in fairly great detail in the book that's coming out in a week that I've done with Philip Gurevich. You know, I'm making a movie. I know that there's all of this. Everyone wants me to be Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter, who suddenly, you know, I become Superman. I'm gonna take out the administration in one fell swoop. I just wrote an editorial for the Huffington Post. We know a lot about this administration. We know a lot about the chain of command. We know a lot about, you know, the attempts to abrogate international conventions, laws. One law that immediately comes to mind is the U.S. Constitution on the part of this administration, and yet people don't act on it. It's not, I don't think the story here is a paucity of information about about the chain. I think it's a poverty of will on the part of the American people to contend with what's actually going on around us. I felt it was a story that other people had dealt with and was not the story that interested me. Chris asked me this question about, you know, returning to the whole question of the essence of the war. The essence of the war is, to me, again, scapegoating and the passing of the buck, not dealing with actually stuff that's right at hand. And that story is very powerfully told with these people, far, far more powerfully than just to engage in that same kind of scapegoating myself and trying to look for some unitary source higher up in the chain of command. I think there's something really, really deeply troubling about this story, different from what people imagine. I mean, we live, as we all know, in a country that is terribly, terribly polarized. I hear people talking about the failure of Iraq movies, mine included, as if it's some kind of a phenomenon that just needs to be discussed at arm's length. What people really don't discuss, maybe they're just everyone's hoping, ostrich-like, that, you know, time will pass, there will be an election in November, and that next year Barack Obama will take office and that we can try to forget about this whole period of the Bush administration as a bad dream. I can't say that I'm immune to that kind of thing. I don't know what you're supposed, you know, people ask me, what are we supposed to do? What is a citizen supposed to do in this kind of mess? I made the movie. That's what I did. And I tried to examine some of these things. But, yes, I don't think the movie will change much of anything. I think people really don't want to think about this. The word that comes to mind is denial.
Mike, you asked a good question. You got a good answer.
Was
that okay?
I was wondering if you could discuss the image as it operated within the prison system, a site of power. And Bentham writes about the prison system that he noticed a panopticon where you could see everything, and power was exerted through being able to see everything and being able to control with omniscient knowledge or total knowledge.
Right.
However,
I like the comparison with Bentham.
Cool. so let's keep going with it. So, but then I see a twist in this logic when we're able to use digital photography to take images of the prison system itself. So rather than being able to see everything, we only see a tiny little snapshot of what was going on in the prison system, of how power operates. So it's you only see what you want to see, and it's cropped.
Let me ask you
image.
A question, because this is when I first started on this project, I had a long discussion with Mark Danner about the question, why were these photographs taken? And Mark said to me, well, I think that it was orchestrated by the authorities in order to create material that could be used to blackmail prisoners. That never sat well with me. It never really quite made sense. You know, the whole idea of a panopticon, or the idea of omniscience, of being able to see everything in a prison, it suggests it's the authorities who's seeing everything. And here, what's so interesting about it is it's not the authorities. It's the little guys. For the very, very first time, the little guys are empowered in a remarkable way. They wittingly or unwittingly influence policy. I don't know if I can think of any story from a previous war where you can look at privates and specialists, corporals, sergeants, and say that they had this kind of effect on war policy. But I may have misunderstood what you're saying.
No, I think that was great. One last question I had, though, is how then
does the dissemination of these images in some way also work with power structures so that we get these images and we see how power operated in the prison system, and we get the voice of the person from down below, the picture up, and it's a tiny frame rather than
well, in my movie you do, frame. But yeah. Those voices were unheard, I would say, prior.
Yeah, and they also sort of seem to me to be in a prison of these images that they took, their image in the media system.
I have to get your name so I can quote you with attribution.
It's Phil.
As Phil said.
Yeah. But do you think there's a way in which the way these images eventually made it into the public also can tell us a little bit about the logic of power in our times?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that really, really fascinates me is just like we have to have villains, we also have to have heroes. I was discussing this with Philip Gurevich recently, and I said to him, why do we have this incredible need for villains and heroes? And he became very wistful, and he said, well, at least villains exist. And but there was this guy named Joseph Darby, who I chose not to put in the movie, for who was the hero of Abu Ghraib, who supposedly turned these images into CID. Everybody thinks, who knows a little bit about the story, that he got a Profiles in Courage Award, so on and so forth. He got a loving tribute by Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes, that he was an endorsement by none other than our ex-Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld himself, who outed him, who made his name public. What's so interesting about it is Darby had nothing whatsoever to do with the release of the pictures. Hmm. I find this somewhat amusing. That the pictures were leaked by unnamed sources to Cy Hirsch and to Dan Rather and Dan Rather's producers. It had really nothing whatsoever to do with Darby's turning the photographs over to CID. The Army did everything in their power to suppress the photographs. We would know nothing about them except for people whose name you don't know and actually can't even be mentioned.
Hmm. Do you know?
I do.
Hmm. We have ways of getting that from you.
I know. I'm just wondering, what will he do?
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jessica Carey, and I'm a senior here at Brown. And I wanted to go back to the issue of public denial that you touched on earlier. And as a young person and a journalist and somebody who's politically pretty progressive, I look up to Watergate and the work of Woodward and Bernstein as this kind of ideal of what journalism is supposed to do. You know, they uncovered abuses that were happening higher up, and it led to the resignation of a president. Today, the information is out there, as people like Seymour Hirsch and Jane Mayer, who you've talked about, have published it, and you have clearly told this story in your film. But even though we can intuit, beyond knowing the actual information, that this is coming from higher up, and it's a culture that's handed down from authority to the people, yeah. You know, the little guys, as you say, where is the outrage? Where is the resignation and the trial? You know, why hasn't it happened the same way? Why are we so content with these scapegoating narratives?
I don't know. I think in part it's because I should speak for myself, I feel that our institutions have failed us. I am a person who has always believed in the Supreme Court. I remember reading Gideon's Trumpet years and years and years and years ago, and thinking, what a great country this is, that a non-entity like Clarence Earl Gideon can take his case before the Supreme Court of the United States and obtain relief, change the law for everybody in this land, secure the right to have representation by counsel. I grew up, it was drummed into me, Checks and balances, checks and balances, the three branches of government, the U.S. Constitution. I'm an American, and I have truly believed in some fundamental way in these institutions and the fact that they would see our country through thick and thin. Everybody I know, of course, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that tells you something right there. The dismay at the role the Supreme Court played in 2000.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the end.
Scalia was quoted as saying, you know, someone going back to that 2000 decision, get over it. Well, you know, I'm terribly sorry, Justice Scalia. I am not going to get over it. I will never in my lifetime get over it. You know, and then the feeling the country is so horribly, horribly polarized. I don't think Vietnam compares to this, really.
Mainly because it's silent today. The polarization is so subdued or so inarticulate.
You're asking me. I'm not sure I can give you a... I sometimes think that people have heard the same arguments over and over and over again. Like, for example, the argument about torture, which I think is an unwinnable argument. It's an argument that I would just love to stay clear of. You try to address the question, is torture in some set of circumstances permissible? You know, and then someone has to come up with various cockamamie possibilities, ticking atomic bombs, the one person who knows the secret code, blah, 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 blah. You've all heard it, you know, hundreds if not thousands of times. To me, it's a deeply uninteresting question, probably because I don't think in a free society that torture plays any role whatsoever. And I also don't believe that's a way you get information from people. I think it's ethically wrong and pragmatically stupid. But
tell Jack Bauer that on 24.
Yeah.
He uses it at least 1 hour out of 24.
On one level, why is Mark Swanner not prosecuted for the death of Al Jamadi? Mm-hmm. I can deal with these questions because at least I can kind of wrap my simple-minded investigator's mentality around it. I can say, okay, Sabrina gets blamed because she's in the photograph. They think she's the culprit. Let's blame her because she's standing next to the corpse. We have a photograph of it, and she's smiling. By the way, I got the world's greatest living expert on the smile to analyze the smile in the photograph. That's at the end of my essay. But anyway, why is Mark Swanner not prosecuted?
No image.
There is no image, but we don't have a, maybe even with an image we wouldn't have prosecuted him. I don't know. There is so much overwhelming evidence. You know, I'm not a trial attorney, but I have spoken to trial attorneys about it. If I were to muster a case against this man, I would have a lot of really, really strong evidence, not just of homicide or involuntary manslaughter, but I'm talking about murder. Why doesn't it happen? Our country gone just... So I will write this essay. The New York Times is already watering it down in 100 different ways.
Why is the New York Times watering down your piece?
I don't know. Now I'm morally tainted. I'm the guy, I'm the checkbook journalist of du jour, you know.
All right.
Hi, my name is Emma, and I'm sorry to stray from this particular topic.
Oh, no, no. Please be my guest.
So you're using these iconic photographs as kind of a jumping-off point, and, you know, you've made the film, but you've also been writing these essays for the Times, ostensibly blogging the New Yorker piece with Philip Gorevitch was part of the book. Yeah. I'm just wondering what each one of these different mediums kind of adds to the mix and the discourse that
you're creating. It's a question very much on my mind, and I thank you for the question. It used to be, you would make the movie, you would pack everything into the movie like a sausage casing. Now, okay, I'm sitting on this huge pile of stuff. You know, I can't even, you know, even reckon with it myself. Philip tells me 1.5 million words of transcript. It's grown since then. It may be 2 million. Tens of thousands of pages of stuff, pictures, this, that, and the other thing. I can't put that all in a movie.
Well, one thing you've got to consider seriously is making it generally available on the web and asking your viewers and your readers and believers of all sorts to vet it with you. I mean,
I would love to do that.
Joshua Michael Marshall has made history by, on Talking Points Memo, about sort of delegating the search of the evidence on the U.S. Attorney's case that brought Gonzalez down. I mean, he basically said, I can't read all of this, love. Have at it.
See, that's brilliant. I mean, I should, because I thought of putting everything that I have online. And I also thought of why not invite the Times readership? Let's go indict Mark Swanner. Help me. What?
Well, we were this close to closing the deal on this. We had a designer, we had the web team, we had everything. The participant got a little weak in the
Rosie
knees.
Rosie has gone through all of this with me. Yeah. Really can't take it any longer. Nah. I can't take it any longer. It's But we should talk about this.
Okay. We talked for 3 months. I'm exhausted as well. But
I find the quantity of material daunting, and I. I start to feel really, really lonely and depressed, and I also start to think I can't do this anymore, which may well be true. And I would welcome people going and digging through this stuff. Mm. I like the idea that it's the people.
Yeah.
The one danger, of course, is that it just devolves into a kind of a food fight, and left and right, But that doesn't have to happen. It could actually turn into something very powerful and interesting.
Are you going to show some final rationale? You get the last question, so it's got to help us out here.
Well, I've been thinking about this question for 2 days, so I really hope I phrase it properly. My question has to do with, I guess, a directorial choice, which was to include the information about the love triangle between Lindy, Grainer, and Megan. I thought that was really interesting, especially because Grainer was probably the only big character that wasn't interviewed, so didn't have a chance to sort of defend himself to the camera. And I was interested in why you made that decision, since it made it a lot easier to vilify Grainer as a character.
Yeah. I don't know if I can completely defend it. It's part of the story, of course, but there was the perverse part of me, which might be 97.6%. I just love the idea of a love triangle destroying the world. Can a love triangle destroy America's conception of itself?
Did to another empire, Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Julius Caesar?
Well, you know, we just, I have my own version of Santayana's famous remark. Those who are unfamiliar with history are condemned to repeat it without an ironic sense of futility.
It could be our last word. Mm. Thank you.
Give it up for Errol Morris.